to put together a constitution for our country, they're an awful time. They seem, most of what they did was gabbling like geese and getting nowhere. And then a certain man by the name of Ben Franklin, who was not an outstanding Christian at all. In fact, he seems to have been pretty close to being a free thinker, which wasn't a very good thing, said he thought that it would be good for the group that was formulating the Constitution to call on the Supreme Being for aid. And from then on, they had a chaplain, and they began their sessions with prayer to the Supreme Being, which sounds a little deistic, doesn't it? But it is said they got along much better after that. They quit gabbling and got down to business and produced our Constitution. Now, in our synod, we have had always a group that was against chaplains for Congress and for the legislature, and we've had those that were against military chaplains, didn't want them. And what was the reason why they didn't want them? They said that is unionism. Now, have you heard much about unionism in your years here? Who thinks he heard much? Who thinks he didn't hear much about unionism? Is there anybody who heard nothing about it? All right. When I went to seminary, we heard a lot about it. If it was a question whether a thing was unionism or not, then you could be pretty sure it was. It always was. Now, they felt, how did they define it? The term, do you know where the term unionism originated? Shane Roddy?
Oh, the Prussian unionism.
Yes. Yes, when the Prussian rulers tried to force Lutheran and Reformed into one church, communing together and working together in everything. The term for it was unionism. There was a term for it earlier, syncretism. And the Germans had a real German one. Religionsmengerei, mixing the churches and the religions together. But the term syncretism, later when unionism came in, the term syncretism became more specialized, and today it signifies Christian and non-Christian religions fellowshipping together. For instance, if we'd have a celebration with the Jews and the Mohammedans together, and the Christians, that would be called syncretism. But formerly, when Catholics and Protestants had any doings together, they called it this. But later on, unionism became the term. But you know what happens with terms. As they go along, it's like with ships in the ocean. Barnacles attach themselves to the ships, and the going gets heavier, and so in time all kinds of other ideas attach themselves to the term unionism, not only between Lutheran and Reformed, but also between Lutherans who were not agreed together. For instance, LCA and ALC and Missouri, if they work together, that's unionism, according to some people. Now, these things cost us a great deal of difficulty. There was the question of military chaplaincies. Does a military chaplain have to engage in syncretism or unionism? Is there danger that he might?
It's almost automatic in some areas.
Yeah. And I guess you would have to ask how you define unionism. I'd like to read you something from the Air Force manual, which a student who had been in the Air Force brought to me. And listen and see whether you think that this is the way it is, or whether this is just what they say. He says, the chaplain is in the Air Force as a clergyman of his particular religious faith, and the Air Force expects him to continue his ministry and religious stewardship in the spirit and tenets of the church of which he is a member. Now, how did it sound? Good or bad? Sounded very good, did it not? It goes on. Section 1125, Revised Statutes, provides that all chaplains shall, when it may be practicable, hold appropriate religious services for the benefit of the commands to which they may be assigned to duty. Does it get stickier here? Yeah, I guess it does, but look that it says, when it may be practicable, they shall do it. Go ahead, Saunders.
Yeah, the Missouri Synod chaplains in the Air Force are usually assigned to a base to include more Protestant chaplains just for that purpose. The Missouri Synod chaplains have a reputation to do
something different. Yeah, I think you are right.
Your base commander will not force upon them.
Now let's see whether we can have heard you correctly. Are you saying that Missouri Synod chaplains, by and large, are not compelled to engage in unionistic practices? All right. That's in accord with the Air Force manual. That's in accord with the statement from the Air Force manual.
Correct. The Air Force does not require a chaplain to do anything that is against the conscience.
All right. Very good. Now, let's keep on going and hear some more and get as much clarity into this business as we're able. The chaplain is morally obligated to provide for the religious needs of the entire command. The chaplain accomplishes this objective through his own personal services and through the cooperative efforts of others. So if a Jewish boy needs religious service very badly, and the chaplain, the Christian chaplain, says, I cannot do this, what can the chaplain do? Yes? He goes and calls in a rabbi for this man. Now, would all Missouri Synod Lutherans countenance that this chaplain called the rabbi? I think some would say that was unionism. Probably would happen less today than it would have happened 50 years ago, but I wouldn't say that it's dead. No chaplain is required to conduct any service or rite contrary to the regulations of his denomination. It's a good statement again. Moreover, no chaplain is required to officiate jointly in a religious service with a chaplain or civilian of another denomination. Now that gets at unionism, and it says no man is to be compelled to do this. The chaplain's spiritual authority is imparted in the ordination that his denomination has given him. The rituals and rules of his denomination are consequently his guides in these matters. That's a pretty fine statement. The chaplain is professionally responsible to his own church for the manner in which he discharges his religious duties He is not free to introduce variations unless he is granted that freedom by his denomination. That's again a pretty fine statement. Well, I thought I should bring this in, but there are now many, many questions. It used to be a big debate
about baccalaureate services, whether a Lutheran, a Missouri Synod Lutheran pastor could preach at a baccalaureate service, and it was greatly considered unionism. Now, I am not particularly defending baccalaureate services. I never preached at one. I did preach at the memorial service, that I spoke at the Memorial Day, and the talk had something of a religious cast, and some folks thought that was unionism. Well, that is expanding the definition from the time when the Prussian kings tried to make Lutherans and Reformed hold communion at the same altar. I think you can see that this is an expanded definition. Now, that expanded definition got into the Lutheran Encyclopedia, the old one. How many of you are acquainted with that blue-bound old Lutheran Encyclopedia? That's where you find this kind of definition. And later, there is more of a return to the original understanding of unionism, and we tried very hard to bring sound principles into the matter when the theology of fellowship was produced. And I can urge you strongly enough to make sure you have a copy of this document and that you study it, because it tries to get down to these particular problems,
to be thoroughly Lutheran and to be thoroughly biblical, but not legalistic, and let Missouri Synod rules get into the way of the Holy Gospel, which it is our duty to preach. Now, I wonder whether there is discussion there. Shane Roddy?
You know, one thing that strikes me when talking about the relationship of church and state is that it's still irritating that the church is rather inconsistent on the thing that, yeah, basically, when we say separation of church and state, but boy, we like to push for the prayers in the public schools, and we want to push to keep God in God we trust in our money, even though that's a big layout. I mean, you have atheists going into court and being asked to swear in and use this money, and it just seems to me that as far as the church can go is to ask for the right to speak, just even academic business with the mandate that we can present our side of the way we see things, but it just seems in so many little ways like that, I can really deal with the agnostic and atheist, and just kind of feel that we're ramming it down the throat.
Well, you see, that sometimes happens. That happened about the time of World War I, when I guess it was the 17th Amendment was passed that forbid all liquor except for communion services and not weddings, that was banned there, but medicinal purposes. And actually what happened as a result, it brought in the bootlegger and the speakeasy, and that fed organized crime, and so what came out of that well-meant attempt by Methodists and others to legislate people's morals was a great deal of immorality. The principle that the state must be ruled according to reason is a good principle, and we ought to be willing to stand by it. All right?
Well, then, just in passing, we should be more than a little bit disturbed when some guy comes into court or someone's going to be sworn in for public office, and he has swear to tell the truth, so help me God, and he says it's so pious, you know. And maybe the guy's an agnostic. I mean, it's no DLC thing, just that we have the mustard with it.
All right, let's see once whether there is any recourse for a poor fellow like that who is supposed to say, so help me God, and he doesn't believe there is a God. Now, were there other people anciently and not so anciently too, who objected to swearing? I think Quakers and Mennonites, what were they allowed to substitute for the oath? A solemn promise. They promised to do it. And maybe the agnostics in our time would be given the same permission. I don't know what happens in their case. I have no case in mind. But the point is, you want to get people to tell the truth. Now I'm going to ask a very bad question, and please get you ready for a very bad one. May an agnostic be a truthful person? Yes. That is natural morality with them, and sometimes they are better at it than certain hypocritical Christians that you may run into here and there. I have known of one atheist who was a very honorable person. Yeah?
Jump track a little. Is there a simple, like, one-sentence definition of humanism that is what we see today?
I don't know. Try it in the theology of fellowship. We tried very hard to give a definition of unionism that is correct. The question is always whether in practice it works very well, whether people can work with it. We felt that the definition had been drawn so tightly that it got into the way of the preaching of the Holy Gospel a lot of times. That's too tight. Well, say what?
Yeah, we were just mumbling back here about the, you brought up the Quakers and the Mennonites. What exegetical handstand do Lutherans get on to justify the taking of an oath, since the Lord says specifically, swear not at all? And James echoes it again and says, let your answer be yes or no for whatever is smart and will come to evil.
Would you not there want to take the context into consideration? The Lord was speaking to people who were frivolous in the way they were swearing. And there are also other passages about the oath for confirmation is to them an end of all strife, the Bible says, and there is no criticism.
But why does he say in all the constant doesn't tell him to swear right at the end or not at all?
He isn't talking about in court, he is talking about their everyday life, where there were anything.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm
Thank you.